Welcome to Asia Inside Out, the signature podcast of the Asia Society Policy Institute. Asia Inside Out brings together our team and special guests to take you behind the latest policy headlines and provide an insider's view on regional and global affairs. Each month, we'll deliver an interview with informed experts, analysts, and decision makers from across the Asia Pacific region. I'm your host, Rory Daniels, Managing Director of the Asia Society Policy Institute. And if you want to dig into the details of the latest policy trends and why they're important, this is the podcast for you. This month, I have the privilege of introducing you to Dr. Kong Kyung-hwa, Asia Society's new president and CEO, who comes to us with decades of experience in international policy issues, including serving most recently as the Republic of Korea's 38th Minister of Foreign Affairs and the first female to serve in that role. Dr. Kong is also no stranger to our New York City headquarters, having also served in many high-level roles at the United Nations, including on the topics of human rights, humanitarian affairs, as well as serving as senior policy advisor to the current Secretary General, Antonio Gutierrez. Dr. Kong and I discuss her background, her career, her mentors, and how they have shaped her own vision of leadership and vision for the Asia Society, as well as for international policy issues. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Kyung-hwa, welcome to Asia Inside Out. We are just so thrilled to have you here as our new Asia Society president and CEO. And you've had a really distinguished career in a lot of high-level policy positions, but you're here at Asia Society, a global nonprofit, at a time when it feels like our policy challenges, whether we're talking about security or climate or global governance, they are so complex and interwoven that they seem overwhelming, even to policymakers. From your perspective, what do you think the role for nonprofits like Asia Society is at this time?
Well, first of all, very happy to be joining the team here in Asia Society. After a week here, I have a strong sense that this is a house full of very passionate, dedicated, very creative staff. So really, really happy to be a part of the team. You know, I recall saying by one of our former presidents in Korea, who said something to the in Korean, but I think the last refuge of a healthy democracy is the organized voice of thoughtful, informed citizens, and civil society, basically. I think we can make that analogy with the global community these days. There's so much tension, fragmentation, and the world is fraught with all kinds of risks, and governments are having a hard time talking to one another. And I think the global civil society, you know, of institutions like Asia Society, I think has an increasingly important role to play in the global scheme of things. And Asia Society in particular, because so much of the center of gravity of global affairs is moving to Asia, Asia Society's bridge building, the creator of platform for inclusive dialogue, thoughtful policy analysis and recommendations, arts and cultural exchanges to bring people together. This is more important than ever before. And I think, therefore, Asia Society's presence, not just here in the United States, but globally in throughout our many centers around the world, have an increasingly important role to play in creating that space for dialogue that is not confrontational, but with all the goodwill of all participating to find creative solutions and the dynamism for co-prosperity and peaceful resolutions of difficult issues.
Yeah, completely understand that. I think that, you know, the different pillars that you described, whether we're approaching that bridge building process through arts and culture or policy, it really feels that, you know, the challenges are so complex that you can't even separate those things out anymore. So really appreciate the thought of how global civil society can address some of these challenges. Mm-hmm. You know, you have spent a lot of your career working mm-hmm. on women's advancement and empowerment. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear your reflections about your time working on those issues at the United Nations. Mm-hmm. You chaired the Commission on the Status of Women mm-hmm. At the UN. And, you know, from my perspective, these commissions can feel very abstract, right? Mm-hmm. They have big titles, mm-hmm. the status of women, but it's sometimes hard for a policy audience and a general audience to understand the impact mm-hmm. that those types of convenings or mm-hmm. missions can have. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about your experience chairing.
Well, it started back in 1995 in mm-hmm. Beijing, the UN Fourth World Conference on Women. And there I participated as one of many Korean NGOs. And we went, 95 organizations went together as the Korean National NGO Committee. And I acted as the spokesperson for our NGO committee. So it was a collective effort and we had a lot of fun. But just being there in this global context with women from all over the world, it just made me realize the UN deals with issues that are central to my own life.
Right.
And so that was a real awakening for me. But then 10 years later, I had become a diplomat and I had joined the mission in UN and to be chairing the Commission on the Status of Women at its 10th anniversary of Beijing. Mm-hmm. In Beijing, 1995, that document of the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action is still the Bible for right. women's advancement and gender equality, together with the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, two documents. So here I am 10 years later, and I'm chairing this. And we had at the time changed governments in the United States. So the administration that was very in favor of Beijing had gone out. Mm-hmm. And now we had a conservative administration that, from the very beginning process of preparing for Beijing plus 10, that we can no longer reaffirm the Beijing Declaration because of its wording on the abortion issue.
I see.
I think, but actually the Beijing Declaration was is crafted because, you know, countries have different standards, different legal boundaries as what is allowed in terms of abortion. So the words are very carefully crafted to say, basically, where legal, abortion has to be safe and accessible. So mm-hmm. it doesn't say whether it's itself what that legal boundary is. So leave it up to individual countries to spell that out.
Right. The emphasis is on the
access
to
safety.
And safety rather than on is abortion good, bad, or are we indifferent?
No, right, mm-hmm. right. So, but then I think the conservative government, the White House at the time, wasn't happy with that. So from the very set, we cannot reaffirm Beijing. We cannot reaffirm that declaration 10 years later. And of course, chairing this commission, which is all about follow-up to Beijing, this would have been, you know, we would destroy Beijing, the hard work that went in, the hard work 10 years later to implement that. So the whole year was, you know, back and forth with the American delegation on how we can find a way out of this. But I had a wonderful partner in the head delegate of the U.S. administration to basically drive home the point to the White House in the end that this does not endorse abortion. It gives individual countries space to craft. So in the end, but it was a lot of staging. It was a lot of, you know, theatrics almost to get the White House convinced that this is safe to reaffirm. And, you know, that required a whole year of planning to be able to do this in 2005. But that also made my name as a leader in the women's rights movement. I think lots of people were watching. Mm-hmm. Kofi Annan was watching through his closed circuit TV. And it in the end, a simple political declaration that fully reaffirms Beijing documents in its entirety. But if we hadn't been able to do that, it would have been a disaster. Huh? So that was certainly a memorable experience for me. And at the time, I was only a minister counselor at the mission.
Sure.
But being a 10-year anniversary, we had like something like 90 ministers coming as head delegates. So we had to move the meeting from the basement room 3 to the GA hall. And so I was sitting there on the podium as a mere minister counselor, you know, bossing around these ministers. So
sure.
It was a strange, but it's of course a very, very exhilarating experience. But that reputation and that accomplishment with the women's group then segued into the discussions on the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities.
Okay.
Because there, then we've decided to focus on the women with disabilities because, mm-hmm. you know, there are some of the most vulnerable segments of the population, you know, the discrimination that comes with women and being disabled is just, I think. So we work very hard to put in a separate clause on women with disabilities in the mm-hmm. convention. A hard uphill struggle, but we succeeded. Those are two issues, women's rights and disabilities rights, and we were able to bring it. And I have to say, this has made a huge difference for women with disabilities on the ground for those countries that have ratified on are implementing this convention, because that standalone article forces the state, the government, to report back on that article to the committee that monitors the implementation.
So put some pressure on
government, and it's a tool.
Progress.
Yes, and it's a tool for women's disabilities groups mm-hmm. to push government.
Right.
To take the right actions for women with disabilities. And so, you know, it's a simple clause, but I'm amazed to see in so many countries what a difference it has made in the everyday lives of women with disabilities. So, yes, so I guess, and you know, policies and positions are the result of a collective effort in government. But on these two, I can take some personal credit.
I love this story, honestly, because I think it is this quiet diplomacy
yes.
that is not, you know, the headline grabbing moment,
no.
you know, Dr. Yeah. Minister Counselor Kang Kyung-hwa convinces the American delegation to uphold the Beijing declaration. It doesn't always get the attention, but it's those personal connections.
Yes.
It's that, you know, dogged persuasion
yeah.
of reframing issues so
right.
that they are universal to
yeah.
different administrations that actually moves the policy
yeah.
needle forward.
Yeah. yeah.
So thanks for sharing that. I love hearing those yeah. stories because it reminds me that what these commissions do or what the United Nations work mm-hmm. do, even if it's a single person mm-hmm. pushing their issue forward, mm-hmm. does make a huge difference
yeah.
in the world.
Yeah, and these commissions, yes, sometimes they look non-functional. Sometimes there are countries sitting on these. And these commissions are, by the way, intergovernmental.
Right.
They're not individual experts sitting at the table. It is government representatives.
Right.
And therefore, governments, as we know, you know, they fight, clash all the time on issues. And it's the same that's happening in these commissions on the status of women, Human Rights Council. And you can say, well, that government certainly doesn't have the profile to be on that commission, for example.
Right.
Yeah, but still, this is where issues get discussed. It is where civil society groups can register
yes.
their positions.
Right, so you don't have to be a model actor on an issue to have your presence on those commissions
no.
have impact and value.
Of course, because in the end, you get elected by other governments mm-hmm. to the commissions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there's a principle that, you know, I think, for example, in the Human Rights Council, you pledge
right.
as part of your candidacy to be on the council, I pledge to, you know, pass this ratify this convention. That there's that, but still there's lots of questions raised about the countries that put their names up for these seats in these commissions or council. Still, I think it's you know, where would we go and have these discussions? In the end, it's ultimately the governments that are responsible for the policies and the laws that they implement in country. And so it's extremely important, I think, that you have these places where governments mm-hmm. come together to discuss these issues. And the power of that rallying, that convening power for governments, but also NGOs and the agenda setting that goes on mm-hmm. is very important.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I've had the experience now of working with you for only 1 week, but on your very first day here, mm-hmm. we had a group of students coming in from Asia, and it might have been your very first hour working at Asia Society, because it was early in the morning, as I recall, and I saw a young woman come up to you absolutely thrilled to meet you in person, to tell you her story,
yes.
To take a picture with you. And it just reminded me how much young women look up to you personally mm-hmm. as a role model. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear about your role models. Uh-huh. Who were role models for you early in your career mm-hmm. or in your life? Mm-hmm. And how did they shape your mm-hmm. development path to have you, you know, go through these very interesting high-level policy positions and end up as president of Asia mm-hmm. Society today?
Well, I can certainly recall many, many important figures in my life, but I certainly would go point to my father, who's mm-hmm. been who's passed away a long time ago, but he's a first-generation broadcaster in Korea and a North Korean. He's originally from North Korea, but came down south during the war times, right? So, but he's always had this an approach toward his colleagues as a team, and always mindful. He managed more downwards than upwards. So, at every holiday seasons on Lunar New Year's holiday, which is big, and I remember all of his juniors would make their rounds. Make their pay, do calls on the higher ups, but all congregate at home in our house, in our little house, and would eat the dumpling soup that my mom and we three young daughters had to make. My father had this personality who really cared for his team. And I think some of that has rubbed off on me. So I always find it much more exhilarating to be working as a team than an individual, right? Mm-hmm. But in my career, I think, and I think my mother also, she didn't have a career, but she was absolutely dedicated to the family and the raising of the three girls. And both were completely empowering. I think rare for that time mm-hmm. when girls were to be protected.
Sure.
And
maybe
boys
had some
were
very clear paths ahead of them
right.
that were
yeah.
not to be deviated
right.
from.
Mm-hmm. And boys be ambitious, but girls sure. be, you know, nice and, you know, courteous. But my parents were not that. They, mm-hmm. I think, rarely said no to me. You know,
as a parent, I have many questions about this.
But maybe in those times it was easier to be parenting, right? But
perhaps.
I don't know. But for example, when this was such a long time ago, when our first big rock concert with Mr. Cliff Richard from the UK coming to perform
nice.
At a huge auditorium at Ewha University, which was the only arena at that time big enough to hold a rock concert. It was right in the middle of our midterm exams. And I said, I have to go. And my mom tried to stop me, but in the end, she let me.
Okay.
So I went and aced all three courses the next day. Maybe
there
it was.
Go.
There you go. It says something about inspiring and empowering and, you know, letting your kids make that decision. But they've been like that throughout my formative period.
Mm-hmm.
But one In career, I think I can count four people.
Okay.
And I always say you need both mentors on the both sexes. You need a woman, you need men, mm-hmm. whether you're a woman or a man yourself. So, and I had two great women mentors, one in Korea. Her name is Lee Yeon-suk. She's a former chair of the National Council of Women. She's a former member, I think two-time member of parliament and minister of gender. She's always been, again, somebody who, you know, really worked as a team and empowering and always keeping up the positive spirit,
right?
Even as difficult the situation might be. And she, I always count her as one of my mentors. And then once in the UN system, Louise Arbour, the former prosecutor for the Yugoslav tribunal, who went after Miloslav. And then I think she was then returned as Supreme Court judge in Canada, and Kofi Annan asked her to be high commissioner. And she asked me to be her deputy. And she remains still my mentor and friend. I was just talking to her yesterday. But she has this mind that just is one, two steps ahead of everybody. So I've learned so much from her. But a great deal of humor as well. Mm-hmm. And then on the men's side, I think President Kim Dae-jung, I was so lucky to interpret for him. Mm-hmm. Right by him as he engaged these big leaders. And for nearly 3 years, yeah. I learned so much and what it means to run a country, to see the world, and then to manage the country's relationship with key partners.
Right.
So, you get to see many, many different world leaders. And this at a time when the country was going through the IMF crisis, mm-hmm. Going through economic restructuring, and also at a time when the president was pursuing his policy of the sunshine policy, engagement with North Korea. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what his thinking was spelled out in his conversations with key partners. I think he's had like 6-7 close encounters, very close heart-to-heart discussions with President Clinton, for example. And so it was such a learning experience for me. I saw President Kim Dae-jung and First Lady Lee Hyo, who was also a very close friend. They, I think, were the happiest when they were having dinner on the eve of the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize. The day before, the committee invites the two of them to dinner, just to heart-to-heart conversation. And this lasted, I think, 4 hours, and I was there interpreting. But he was so happy, so honored.
Yeah.
It was the happiest that I saw the two people, the two couples that I greatly admired. Mm-hmm. So I would also count Lee Hyo, his wife, who was instrumental, who was a real partner to him, especially when it came to women's issues. It was during his time that a lot of the key reforms that makes Korea what it is today, an IT powerhouse, a soft, culture powerhouse, great medical insurance system, mm-hmm. and the gender ministry. Mm-hmm. And some key legislative changes towards gender equality was implemented during his term.
Right.
So it's amazing how visionary his leadership was at the time. And then I think I would also count Mr. Ban Ki-moon, his leadership in the UN system. Also, I admire him for his decisiveness in doing things that could go wrong.
And taking risks.
Taking risks, not afraid of failure. Right?
How did he deal with failure from your perspective?
I think, while I was in the UN, I wasn't close. I was one step removed as mm-hmm. deputy in OACHR and OCHA. But once in a while, when the principal was not around, I would go to his principal. I think he could get very angry at failure.
Sure.
But he wasn't afraid of taking charge of a crisis situation that could end up in disaster. Mm-hmm. I think what is not, heard about much, but which I think should be, was how he tackled the West Ebola crisis. It was no longer a WHO issue. It was a public health security issue. So it was the first, and I believe the only, public health crisis issue that he took to the Security Council, created a Security Council mandated mission for the West Ebola countries. He went himself to visit and created, put in a structure endorsed by the Security Council to come to grips with this. And it was only then that finally we started having some sense of, now we're controlling this. We have a sense of where this is going in, and it's controllable. But it was a terrible time to be in the UN system because nobody knew what this was. Staff on the ground were saying, we can do what we want, we need to do, but please tell us you will evacuate us if we get this. Right. Nobody could guarantee that, right?
Right.
Staff wanted to go with if guaranteed that they can come back and work again. And then we were all at a loss. It was because the fatality rate was so high and the system wasn't in place. But anyway, so he took that challenge on. And then in the end, he succeeded. So,
yeah, that's a wonderful glimpse into, the power of the UN Secretary General
at
times. And I think that I know for in terms of U.S.-China relations, for example, working together on the Western Africa Ebola crisis did set up patterns of cooperation that the U.S. and China were able to build upon, even to create Africa Center for Disease Control, which, of course, as we know now, would have been decisively helpful at the outbreak of the COVID crisis. Mm-hmm. So, I'm struck as well by how you describe your mentors in terms of their values and their complete personalities, and really appreciate that, that, it is, there's so many wonderfully brilliant people out there in the world working in government and the international system. But sometimes what distinguishes you is your humor, your ability to take risks. Those are all, your parents' kind of understanding of treating you like a complete person and not pigeonholing you into an academic setting, letting you go to concerts, these other things. So I think those are really valuable lessons to take forward.
Well, I think, we all come to work, right? We have work to do. We have reporting lines.
Yes.
We have supervisory obligations. But at the, and you wear that hat at work, right? But when you take that hat off, you're all equal human beings.
Right.
I think we tend to forget that.
Yes.
And I think I had parents who had a different approach to work. And all of my mentors, I guess, have a similar philosophy about life and work in that sense. And it wasn't so much preaching, but showing by example. And I also think modeling and leadership by example is the best way to nurture future leaders.
Right, right. And that's an area, of course, I think where Asia Society can play a big role, whether it's through our Asia 21 network of rising leaders or the many empowerment programs that we do at the Policy Institute on women's empowerment in trade or creating the next generation of climate and security leaders. I would like to ask you a little bit about your time as South Korea's foreign minister. You served in this post, first female foreign minister of South Korea, at a time that was somewhat challenging, I think. This was in the late 2010s, and the relationship between Korea and China had become quite strained,
right?
Because of security issues, because of Korea's relationship with the United States, the alliance commitments that Korea had made to install a high altitude missile defense system that China felt was encroaching on its ability to exercise military power. But also a relatively constrained relationship with Japan as right. well. Some mm-hmm. of the long-standing issues related to wartime history, right. sex slavery, mm-hmm. forced labor, were right. also becoming a prominent, very mm-hmm. prominent part of South Korea's mm-hmm. culture, mm-hmm. And particularly civil society. Mm-hmm. And so I see you coming into this position at a challenging time, and I would love to hear from your perspective, mm-hmm. you know, what do you think was your largest success? Where did you feel that you had the most policy impact given the constraints of Korea's relationship with its neighbors?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think our alliance with the United States is the key pillar of our foreign and security policy. And we had a U.S. administration that was not typical.
Very much so.
But in a way that... atypicalness was a challenge, but it was also refreshing because the kinds of procedural limitations that we come to expect in governments was no longer there. Example, Mr. Trump would say, I'm willing to meet with Mr. Kim, right? And I think normally that kind of thing would not have happened. So there's the plus and minus to that, but it happened. His request that we give a huge hike to the special measures agreement, i.e. the Korea's share of the cost of the troop station, the U.S. troop station, that was a very big, a tough ask that we just couldn't deliver given our budget set up and the need to go to Parliament in the end to get that endorsed. But still, so that was a big issue. And I think, you know, we couldn't get agreement because in the end, President Trump refused to endorse it, even though it had made it all the way up to my counterpart. So mm-hmm. that was a big disappointment. It got approved by the Biden administration soon after it came on board, on an office. I think on North Korea, you know, very much engagement, trying to bring North Korea to the dialogue table, and in many ways, very successful. We started out saying, we're going to use the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics
right.
as the point where we would bring North Korea to the table. And we did that. I think that was successful. We got a lot of help from countries that had access to Pyongyang, was talking to Pyongyang, had helped us to convince North Korea that they should come to the Winter Olympics. And that started the whole, you know, summitry process of 2018. I think, you know, but on the North Korea engagement, it was really President Moon's. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he said, if there's one thing that I'm going to do on the foreign policy front in my term, I'm going to make things easier to deal with North Korea. I don't think he was aiming for unification or even,
sure.
but just to make dialogue a routine process between the two sides at the summit level, at lower levels, we didn't get that. And he was hugely frustrated. But on China and North Korea, yes, the THAAD deployment, which was a decision of the previous government,
right.
But we had to implement it. Mm-hmm. North Korea kept provoking in the initial months of our administration. So at some point we said, we are going to fully deploy. Mm-hmm. And we did. And that, of course, China was hugely unhappy. So my many meetings in the initial months and year was with Mr. Wang Yi about how this was really about in response to North Korea's continuing provocation, and he wasn't buying it. And then the huge difficulties that China has placed on our companies operating in China.
Right, because so. The company, particularly the Lotte Corporation,
yes.
had given the land on which the missile system was housed.
Bartered.
Okay, I'm sure.
Bartered.
Given was probably right, not
yes,
the right
bartered,
word.
Bartered. Mm-hmm. And so they got huge losses in China at the time. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just Lotte. It was many mm-hmm. other big investments, Korean investments in China.
Right.
And then the Chinese tourists coming to Korea stopped almost overnight. Right. And so our tourism sector suffered a great deal.
Right. And this is common to the experience I think a lot of countries have now had of China using kind of informal sanctions or informal restrictions mm-hmm. on investment in tourism to drive home through economic coercion a political point.
Economic coercion. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. I think,
but you were on the front lines.
I was on the front line, getting the Chinese to roll back mm-hmm. some of these tough measures was big part of my agenda with Mr. Wang Yi. I think mm-hmm. we got most of it rolled back, but not most. So I think still, I can say at least from my point of view, you know, we approached all dialogue with goodwill. Mm-hmm. Best, you know, the intention to find a way forward. The same with Japan. The issues of the past were tough. Mm-hmm. We had a Supreme Court decision that the government, of course, couldn't go against. Mm-hmm. But again, goodwill, difficult, you know, very narrow space to find a way forward. But I thought my discussions with my Japanese counterpart was always based on goodwill. Mm-hmm. And sadly, we couldn't find a solution to the very end. And I think that was my biggest regret of my term as foreign minister, that Japan, I left the Japan-Korea relations in a very difficult situation.
Sure.
So in terms of, you know, me, what did I as foreign minister leave that I can claim as my own legacy aside from the government? It's hard to say because it's always a group endeavor, but I think me as foreign minister selling our policy, mm-hmm. right, vis-a-vis the world, whether it's, you know, engagement with North Korea, there were some firsts for a South Korean minister, for example, to engage with the annual EU foreign ministers lunch to explain our engagement. For example, the first South Korean foreign minister to speak at Chatham House, for example. I had many firsts, public engagements, and as South Korean foreign minister, and invited to Davos, various forums in Davos, what's the German security forum, München forum. Mm-hmm. So a lot of opportunities that came my way that hadn't come to previous foreign ministers.
Right.
So, and I think I handled those pretty well.
Mm-hmm. And then, you opened the door for subsequent foreign ministers take up the mantle and pursue those relationships.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you always build upon your predecessor. Sometimes it's, you know, two steps forward and one step back, but in the longer term, I think it's a progress. And then, of course, during the COVID crisis, it was because we were hit first and we dealt with it quite well. Then lots of countries came to us, wanting to learn from our experience, and wanting on the kits that we had developed. So
yes,
and I think also. Our ability to bring back I think about 50,000 Korean nationals we brought back during mm-hmm. the COVID times, because people are finding themselves, you look at your own country and it looks pretty safe and your surroundings are not. So we had many calls from, you know, in the oddest places around the world saying, please take us out of here. We really tried hard to bring back everyone who wanted to come back.
That is fantastic. And it sounds like an incredibly complex set of logistics and considerations. It's instructive to remember that the foreign minister of a country is not only in charge of communicating policy at a high level, but is also in charge of all of the diplomats and embassies overseas.
Yes.
And therefore... Yeah. By extension, the security and safety of your nationals who are
overseas.
Living abroad.
In fact, by law, I don't know, I think it's pretty similar in other countries. The foreign ministry is the lead ministry in charge of Koreans overseas. Mm-hmm. And that is because when accidents happen to Korean overseas, the mm-hmm. primary authority is the government of that country where that accident happens, right? But the foreign ministry then has to lobby that government to make sure that it's properly investigated and so on and so forth. So things that accidents, and there are small accidents, big accidents. Under my watch, we had a boat sinking in Budapest, for example. And so my immediate reaction was to go. Some people thought, isn't that a little too much for the foreign minister? But I thought, I have to go and talk to my Hungarian counterparts to make sure that this accident is thoroughly investigated and taken care of.
You know, we're trying to, at the Asia Society Policy Institute, put forward recommendations to support peace and prosperity and sustainability across Asia, but also explaining and building bridges and reducing common misperceptions. So I have two questions for you, which you can answer as you please. One is, like, what do you think in 2024 is driving policy decisions in Asia? And then the second question, they may be related, is what do you think are the key or the major misperceptions that the U.S. and the West have about Asian countries, their policymaking, or their societies?
Well, I think, you know, then this is not just this year, but a continuing and intensifying context, which is the U.S.-China rivalry,
right?
And something that hopefully all the world wants this to be managed. Yes, competition, but please manage it, right? And then
the consequences would be catastrophic if the U.S. and China were to not properly manage this competition to get into some sort of war.
Politically, economically. And then I think the misperception, the West versus the non-West. I was sitting in the München Security Forum in 2021, I think, and the topic was Westlessness. It's a period of the West soul searching for its relevance around the world, I thought. And I thought, well, if the Westlessness doesn't mean that the values that are so typically associated with the West are just here and therefore becoming increasingly irrelevant. And South Korea, for example, is a country that is seen as a part of the West, although it is not sitting physically in the West, right?
Sure.
So I think,
but in terms of its democracy, its civil society, freedom of expression,
all of that,
sound legal system, it comports with a lot of the building blocks of what we think of as Western culture.
And I would be careful of calling that Western values now.
Sure, I absolutely agree.
And then, so there's that dimension. And then I think the non-West, the West tends to think of the non-West as a monolith, as a homogenous whole, when obviously it is not. I mean, just in Asia is so diverse. So I think, you know, the West should go out of its way to see the rest of the world in the diversity that it is. And this is not just in terms of the national characters, but in terms of key decision making at the global level. For example, at the UN, we know that many countries are straddling, you know, the fence. You know, countries are picking and choosing where they want their position to land on in these very important global issues. And even among the alliance, you know, the NATO alliance is a collective alliance of a region. The alliance that the United States has in the Asia Pacific region is the spokes and wheel. The spokes have different histories, I think.
Even so, with each other.
Within each other. So I think you have to see each bilateral alliance for what it is and not see it as a, you know, the wheel that the image of the wheel and spokes tends to portray. So yes, I think, you know, a better nuanced messaging about what the West thinks about the non. Maybe we should just throw away the term non-West because it tends to group everything together.
Right, yeah.
And I think in Asia society too, I think, you know, Asia society, yes, China is physically just very big.
and
all manners of global importance. But there you have certainly Southeast Asia with the ASEAN grouping and Indonesia, India, and then West Asia as well, and you also have the Central Asia to the north. We tend to lose sight of that. So I would like also Asia society to be more committed to that full diversity of Asia.
Absolutely. You said something interesting about the alliance structure that I'd like to follow up on if I can. And I think it also gets to maybe a misperception that we commonly hear or think about. You were involved in managing, to the extent that it was part of your portfolio, the U.S.-Korea alliance. And I think so often, particularly when I talk to Chinese counterparts, they really see that alliance structure as the U.S. directive toward the ally. I'm wondering if that's kind of how it plays out in practice or... whether you could shine a little light on what it's like to manage inside an alliance where, of course, one country has a much, much larger, power base, whether that's economic or military power, and the other country is relying on that country for a security guarantee. How do you create a kind of a full and complete partnership when the power is so asymmetrical?
I think that asymmetricity in power is a fact, and you have to work with that. But I think it's also a fact that Korea is increasingly capable. I mean, it's not the junior partner that it was when the alliance was first created, economically, technologically, defense industry-wise. Which is why we're paying increasingly a larger portion of the troop stationing in South Korea.
Right.
So, yes, asymmetry for sure, but I think and Korea has to push for this. The U.S. has to acknowledge the space for Korea and other allies to push for this. So we certainly try to, take that dialogue with our American counterparts to a more of a, an honest equal,
right.
if maybe that's too strong a word, but certainly an honesty, and to acknowledge the what Korea brings to the table, not just for itself, but for America as well. I mean, Korea has lots of things that America needs. Semiconductors, for example.
Yes, increasingly.
Yeah. And so I realize as in all human beings, it's difficult to wean yourself off of existing patterns of dialogue and communication.
Right.
And I think it's wise on both sides that needs to adapt and change to the changing times and the changing capabilities on both sides.
Yeah, so self-reflection and honesty would be the watchwords of managing an alliance relationship.
Yes, yeah. But I have to say, even those unusual times under Mr. Trump's leadership, the dialogue between my counterparts, we were quite honest, genuine. We've had our differences, we've had our disagreements, but I always thought the dialogue was honest.
Fantastic. Before we close, I would like to ask you a very big question about multinational governance, because I just have to take advantage of your time, your significant time in the United Nations system, where you served in so many positions. And reform of the UN system has been just a priority on the table for a long time, and particularly at this moment when we're meeting. It does feel like the Security Council has just hit a brick wall when it comes to resolving or stemming the violence that states are involved in. I mean, you look at Russia's continued military campaign in Ukraine, Israel's struggle with Hamas. Big picture, what's the path forward for the UN? Can our international system help to manage growing strategic mm-hmm. competition and multipolarism? Mm-hmm. Or do the trends actually make the UN more of an arena for conflict instead of a mediator or broker mm-hmm. Of global peace?
I see the fundamental question. I have to say, Security Council, the idea of reforming the Security Council has been around for decades.
Yes.
And there are waves. They come and go in cycles. Mm-hmm. It's on and it's off. Mm-hmm. Every country has a position on this because it is so important. But in the end, no result, right? Reforming the Security Council to reflect better the global political dynamics is a cause that is just, at this point, I think, unrealizable, mm-hmm. right? But that doesn't mean that we don't need the UN. The UN is so much more than the Security Council, although the Security Council sits at the apex of the system, right? My heart aches for all of these committed colleagues still working in the system, and because they're there because they believe in the UN, they believe in the UN and promoting and advancing global public goods. Right. And there are other areas of the global public goods that needs the UN, humanitarian assistance. Where right. would that come from if we didn't have these UN entities? Right. So I certainly let's not the criticism on the Security Council, extend to the rest of the system. I mm-hmm. think what I would like to see member states, and this is more an issue of political will than any real structural change, is that let the international civil servants who work for the cause, let them do their work. Please minimize the political influence. Try not to use the system for your own national political interest. Hard, because I know governments find that hard to do. But if the UN is to have a more productive life, forget about the Security Council reform issue.
Sure.
I think for the whole system, there has to be much less political overbearing by member states. Mm-hmm. All member states, huh? Mm-hmm. It's the big ones, the big players, and the small ones. Mm-hmm. And the staff in the system feel this all the time.
Right. So they need a little bit of space. They need to be empowered and
yes.
To prevent whenever possible obstruction or blockage of their mm-hmm. efforts based on national interest.
Based on political influence from member states who are mm-hmm. The influence is stronger where the issue is of great interest to mm-hmm. the nation. So, it's hard for governments not to, because it's an issue that's important to them.
Sure.
But, the political heavy breathing doesn't help resolve the issue.
Right. So focusing on the results as well is
yes.
a good way to kind of
and also
move the system
a longer
forward.
Term, in the short, we want this language removed, we want that language removed. Well, that's a member state's negotiation, so that's taken for granted. But then to come around the back door to force UN staff members say, that should stop.
Absolutely. Well, I hope that this is the first of many conversations we can have
yes.
With you here now as mm-hmm. our leader at the Asia Society.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you, Rory.
And thank you so much for your time today. This was really fun, and let's do it again.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
That's it for this month's episode of Asia Inside Out. I'd like to thank our intrepid producer, Min Benjamin Hong, and all of the people behind the scenes who contribute to producing and promoting this podcast. Stay tuned next month when we take a deeper dive on Taiwan. And please like, subscribe, and follow our work online at asiasociety.org. Until next time,